As the attorneys are shuffling around, I will call our final case for our calendar this morning, case number A24-1126, State of Minnesota versus Lawrence McDowell. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
As you both know, you'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning. And appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You're doing it already, but please feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort level. And if you would identify yourself and your client for our audio record, that would be much appreciated. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. And good morning, Your Honors. Kyle Kroll, a Special Assistant Public Defender on behalf of the appellant, Lawrence McDowell, and may it please the court. This case is about escalation without cause against a citizen, and I think the court should be greatly concerned by the facts in this case. Mr. McDowell was blocked in a parking space by the police for allegedly having a cracked windshield. No sooner was he stopped than police escalated that stop by ordering him out of his vehicle without cause.
Are you saying the windshield wasn't cracked?
Your Honor, with respect to the windshield, we do not believe that there's sufficient evidence in the record to show that it was cracked so as to present an actual violation of law.
The cracks were on a third of the window in front of the driver. Isn't that true?
There's testimony to that effect, Your Honor, but there's actually no picture showing that that was the case, that it obstructed proper vision. And that's what the test is for whether you would have cause to stop for a traffic stop.
Isn't it still a reasonable suspicion standard as to, I guess, even if as to the violation of the windshield?
Yes, Your Honor.
Like, I guess the officers don't need to know with certainty that the cracked windshield would obscure the driver's side such that they could actually issue a citation for that. But in order, again, we're just at the point of could they have stopped a driver having seen a windshield it's just about whether there's reasonable suspicion to think that windshield crack is serious enough.
I think we agree with you, Your Honor. But the problem here is that it's the state's burden to prove that there was that particular articulable suspicion. They did not do so. All we have is some vague testimony in the record.
But it's an objective standard.
And I was just getting to that, okay. Your Honor. The objective evidence, I think, here is overwhelming the other way. This was something that allegedly was spotted multiple times. There were many opportunities to stop this vehicle, but it never was for this reason. The only time a stop ever occurred was when the police learned that there might be some individual associated with this vehicle, not described in any way, who might be driving it, and that's when they make the decision.
Why that sounds to me like it's a subjective point. You're saying did they actually, or so why? How does that go to objectivity as to whether or not the windshield was cracked, despite the delay? I mean, objective officer, maybe you saw they tried to pull him over, tried to kind of follow, get a better look at the window, which may be different from the actual facts, but.
Well, I think that what makes it objective, we're not saying, well, they really had some other motive. We're saying the objective evidence is this windshield wasn't enough to stop when they saw it multiple times, had multiple opportunities, not one squad car, but two. What reasonable officers do is objective evidence. And so here the objective evidence, we think, does not support the suspicion here. But beyond that, when they did
why isn't the natural result of your argument that the officer needed to say, is the natural result of your argument that the officer needed to say at the hearing, I was concerned that the crack was obstructing vision? Like, is that without that statement, there's not enough in the record for reasonable articulable suspicion?
Yes, because it's the state's burden to prove. They would need to introduce that testimony, or they would at least have to introduce some, you know, images showing that this was the case.
But didn't he testify that there was a large spider web series of cracks on 30% of on the driver's side?
I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor, but what I recall from the testimony was there were cracks and it might possibly affect the ability to drive. The objective evidence is he was able to drive. There was no dispute about that. And, again, multiple times they did not stop him. So we don't think that the state met its burden to prove that there was an objective, reasonable, articulable suspicion to conduct this seizure and stop in this instance.
But you may technically be able to drive, but that doesn't mean that you're able to see clearly what's in front of you because maybe your mirror, your windshield's been cracked. You know, we've all done it probably, and many times maybe when we shouldn't before we get our windshield fixed.
Yes, Your Honor, but...
But that doesn't eliminate the right to stop you if it looks like you got a problem.
When it is the state's burden to prove in a criminal case, the court does not draw inferences such as what I believe you are doing here in the favor of the state. And so they would need to prove that there was something that obscured proper vision. I think for the reasons I've said, we don't believe that that's the case. But I want to turn to the...
So I thought, I mean, and maybe I just interpreted your argument wrong, but I understood your argument, at least partially, to be that, you know, they might have had reasonable articulable suspicion when they first saw the windshield, but the fact that they didn't pull him over sort of immediately upon seeing that, over time, that reasonable articulable suspicion goes away. And do you have any case law to support sort of this temporal idea that, like, at time A, you might have had reasonable articulable suspicion, but once you've sort of moved, right, once we've moved forward in time and you've done nothing, that it doesn't seem like that's actually reasonable articulable suspicion anymore?
You know, Your Honor, I'm going to have to check my notes on that. Maybe I'll try to get that answer for you in rebuttal. I don't have anything off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you.
But I agree with what you're thinking on this. When you look at the totality of the circumstances, eventually it starts to seem, well, there isn't really objective evidence here. If they're repeatedly choosing not to do anything about this, it must not have actually been something that would have been a basis for a stop.
But wouldn't they be taking their time here perhaps to identify the license plate, run it, and determine whether any person or persons in the vehicle might be a danger to them, given where they're patrolling and why they're patrolling?
Yes, and I believe the record reflects that they did that right away, and they did that multiple times, in fact. So there was no reason that they couldn't, there was no inability or they did not lack the information they might need to consider whether to make a stop. I guess is my point, Your Honor.
But can you point to a case where we've ever said that because you hesitated to make a stop, there's a problem?
I can't point you to that case, Your Honor.
A lot of times they follow for a while to see if they're drunk, how much they're weaving, you know?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but that wasn't the case here, though. But beyond the stop, it was an escalation in terms of the searches that occurred as well. The police... When they blocked him in, they ordered him out of the vehicle without any probable cause to do so. You have to have cause to order someone out of a vehicle.
Under Askegard, isn't that allowed? Or Askertooth?
Yes, you have the right case in mind, Your Honor. I believe that case and then the Brown case cited by the district court actually stands for the proposition that the police doesn't have to tell the driver why they're asking them out. But it doesn't stand for the proposition that they don't have to have a basis for ordering them out of the vehicle. You still do have to have that, and I believe the case sets that. But then the drivers...
You need probable cause, you said?
I believe so, Your Honor, or articulable suspicion. I'd have to look back at exactly what the cases say about what you need to order someone out of a vehicle, but you do have to have a reason. And here there was none.
And here, I guess, we're under the assumption that or by the time we get to this point in the case, to the extent we don't agree with your decision on the reasonable suspicion in the first place, let's say but if there is reasonable suspicion on the traffic violation, why isn't that enough, too? Because you already have authority to pull over the car to have somebody come out for a... It was my understanding that that's established that you can... And when you have at least the articulable suspicion of the traffic stop, you can order somebody out of the car for a safety reason.
So, Your Honor, let's assume the stop was reasonable, you still have to, you cannot undertake steps that aren't unrelated to what the basis of the stop was. Here we have a cracked windshield. There's no basis whatsoever to order someone out of a vehicle.
I thought the district court said that the reason that they originally asked him out of the vehicle was because it was between the two spots and the officer couldn't, like, actually fit in the spot to have a conversation with your client. And why isn't that a reasonable reason to sort of, to the extent it's an expansion, to expand the scope of the stop to facilitate the cop being able to ask your client questions?
You can watch the videos yourselves, Your Honors. I believe it's some of the early exhibits in the record. The police officer goes into the space that we're talking about right up to the door. So that just isn't the case. It just wasn't the case. There was no basis for ordering him out of the vehicle and then escalating further by patting him down. There was no basis for a pat down. You have to have cause to conduct a pat down, and that didn't occur here. If he had had a weapon on him at that point in time, that would have been immediately excluded. It didn't occur here, but that was just yet another example of the escalation that occurred. And then they encircle the vehicle, looking inside, and they say they saw an open bottle. But as an evidentiary matter, factually, there is no alcohol bottle here. The bottle was never opened.
There's a pretty obvious bottle when you watch the cam.
If you look, yes, there is a bottle. We don't dispute that there's a bottle because you can see that in the pictures of the video. But they never opened it, sniffed it. When you want to conduct a search because you think there's alcohol in an open bottle container, usually it's because, you pull that bottle out and you look and see what the contents are and you say, yep, it's alcohol. Or you smell it on the breath or those types of things.
Didn't it appear that it had been at least partially consumed? That's my recollection.
I think that's speculation on everyone's part because it's not in the record about what the contents of the bottle were, how much, if whether the bottle normally looks that way or not. It was never confiscated, ever. And it was never tested.
What does it look like in the pictures?
The pictures, to me, it looks like a large glass bottle, and it looks to be some of a brown color. But that's all we know. We know that Mr. McDowell had been at a barbecue. It's within reasonable possibility that we're talking about ingredients for barbecue.
But presumably he could have taken the stand and said that's what it is.
But he has a right to not have to speak in a criminal proceeding, Your Honor.
But aren't we even, the issue wasn't what was in the bottle. That wasn't the issue that the court was deciding. The court was deciding whether the cops, in seeing a bottle like that sitting in a car, had probable cause to think that there was criminal activity happening, like an open bottle in the car. This goes to the question about what establishes probable cause. And do you have any case that requires that in order to show probable cause, you need to know what the liquid is or what the bottle or anything like that? It seems like there are all kinds of cases where cops see open containers and...
I think we're not talking about probable cause. We're still talking about reasonable suspicion.
Well, this is for the search of the car.
For the search of the car, where it turns into, does the state have did the state meet its burden to prove an exception to the warrant?
Yeah, I thought
the search
it was
without
the
a
plain
warrant.
View.
So there's plain view and automobile exception.
Yeah. Well, what about the fact that they identified him as having the same name as the person with the warrant associated with the car?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, that doesn't have anything to do with the search of the vehicle. They had conducted that before that ever occurred. And that wasn't something, they didn't know who he was when they pulled him over, when they started conducting the pat down, when they pulled him out of the vehicle, when they circled the car, when they started doing the search. So all of that was after.
Maybe I'm mistaken here and maybe need to look at it again. I thought the actual search, though, where they found the gun under the driver's seat occurred after they had arrested him, and you're saying it didn't?
I'll have to check, but my recollection of the footage and how this is a very, very fast timeline. Mm-hmm. We're talking about maybe a minute or two.
Right.
So I'll have to check, but that would not be a basis to search the vehicle, though, for anything in particular. The fact that he might have a warrant doesn't suggest that there are bottles of alcohol in the car, for example.
They wouldn't even have to have that because they can search the area that he could reach in the car under search incident to arrest, and certainly he could have reached under the front passenger seat.
The state has never argued that, Your Honor. So The state has only ever argued the plain view.
Well, and he was arrested for the gun. He wasn't arrested prior to the...
Yes, correct, Your Honor. The state did not charge him with any kind of open container violation. Again, it was never confiscated testing or anything. And beyond that,
yeah,
you know,
sorry,
I think...
I thought, maybe I'm just misremembering now. I thought he was arrested because of the outstanding warrant.
Warrant.
Right away.
Yes.
And then the gun charge is separate?
He was arrested because he had a warrant, but then he was charged with being a felon in possession because they found this rusted old firearm under the driver's seat. So that's...
Well, yeah, I guess I was saying, I thought the arrest didn't happen until after the... I thought that the search of the vehicle started when they saw the alcohol bottle and the other officer was having a conversation with your client, and during the search of the vehicle, but maybe I'm not understanding that time.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I would have to go back and compare all the timestamps again. Again, it happened very quickly. But beyond, I mean, this, again, the state has a burden to prove that an exception applies. Saying there's a bottle, but never doing anything to confiscate it or collect it or show that there was a reason for it, we think doesn't meet that. And I see my time is up, and I'll try to be back on rebuttal. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in today's matter. I would like to set aside my prepared remarks and address the court's questions because I think this court is thinking about this case the right way. I'd like to begin with where the court began, which is with the cracked windshield. I'd like to direct the court's attention to page 17 of the omnibus transcript. The question was, were they cracks that were of a type or in a position that would obstruct the view of the driver? The answer was yes. The cracks were almost directly in front of where I was seated in the driver's seat. That is more than sufficient on its face to show that these were cracks that were to a degree that could or would obstruct an officer. And going back to Judge Bentley's point, we're not here to prove the windshield cracked and whether it obstructed. It's whether there was reasonable, articulable suspicion to believe that those windshield cracks would have risen to the level of being a misdemeanor offense. I'd like to turn now to the other question about the bottle, the importance of the bottle. The officers, and I should be specific, Officer Peterson first observed the open bottle when he went up to the passenger side of the driver's area of the vehicle. Detective Peterson walked up and immediately saw the bottle. That's visible on his body-worn camera footage, which are exhibits 6 and 7 of the omnibus transcript or the omnibus hearing.
So what does the bottle look like?
I was just about to get there, Your Honor. It is immediately apparent based on the body-worn camera that there are 4 specific identifying features of this. First, it's a glass bottle associated with liquor. Second, it's a brown liquid, again, associated with liquor. Third, it has a distinct brand symbol on it that is visible from the body-worn camera. If you do a Google image search of that, it's a cognac. The officers didn't know that it was cognac, but that's what that brand symbol represents. And then fourth, it had a stopper that is only and exclusively limited to liquor. Traditionally speaking. So by all accounts, this appeared to be a liquor bottle. And again, I think the court was asking about what's the importance of the liquor bottle versus the subsequent search. So that justified the automobile exception to the warrant requirement. Because when police officers observe an open bottle, that gives them the authority to search the passenger compartment of the entire vehicle and anywhere within that passenger compartment that they can find other incriminating evidence. And of course, that's exactly what happened here. Is the officers then performed that search of the passenger compartment. I'd like to draw the court's attention because it was asking about the specific timeline of that search, and I think it's important to establish that. I think that this court should look at the 4 body-worn cameras that were introduced as exhibits 6, 7 from Detective Peterson, and 10 and 11 from Detective Lovejoy. What it shows is that, roughly in order, they arrive to the squad car. They walk up to him. Mr. McDowell exits the squad car. They then bring him to the back of the vehicle because it's a tight space. They do a brief frisk of his apron. Detective Peterson is sitting right next to them, or standing right next to them, I should say. They then hold him there for a couple minutes while Detective Lovejoy re-enters the squad, runs a records check. That's when he finds that he does, in fact, have an open warrant. Lovejoy exits the squad, places him under arrest by putting him in handcuffs and bringing him to the back of the squad, and then that's when Detective Peterson searches the front driver's side of the car. That's the specific order. And again, going back to, I believe, is Judge Kirk's question, the state maintains that that search was subject to the automobile exception to the warrant required, not a search incident to arrest. Because at that point in time, they'd already taken Mr. McDowell out past the back and the rear part of the car, so he no longer could have grabbed anything in that area. But
wait,
that
wait. On search incident to arrest, there's a specific exception for automobiles. You know, generally, if you've removed him, like, from his home, you can't go back and search the immediate area.
Right.
But if you've removed him from a car, you, as I understand it, you have the absolute right to go back and search the area he could have reached to.
And, Your Honor, I agree with that. I agree with Your Honor. But I also have to respect what my friend across the aisle said, is that the state never raised that below. The state's sole theory for that search of the passenger compartment of the vehicle was the automobile exception. And I should say that that was what the district court found in its omnibus order, and that's quite clear. And again, the state is relying on that because it's so clear-cut going back to the 70s that when an officer observes an open bottle, they can search the entire passenger compartment of the vehicle. That's best represented by the state v. Collard decision.
I have a question on what is... because I agree, Askertooth, it's not quite clear to me from Askertooth whether it is saying that you can remove, because it seems to me like it is an intrusion, it's an additional intrusion to ask a person to be removed
sure.
from their vehicle.
Sure.
Right? If I got stopped for a windshield violation, I would be quite surprised if I was immediately asked to exit my vehicle. So it does seem somewhat like an additional level of intrusion, and I'm wondering what the standard is for what's the standard that we're applying in deciding whether asking someone to exit the vehicle is a reasonable request.
You're pressured, Your Honor, because that's where I was going to next to address
okay.
your question. I actually pulled up the Askertooth decision on page 360, I believe it is, but double correct me. The quote from that case is, quote, "It is correct that a police officer may order a driver out of a lawfully stopped vehicle without an articulated reason." That was citing back to the Supreme Court's decision in Mims. The Askertooth decision then goes on to say that any expansion or inquiry after asking that driver out of that vehicle then has to be justified based on the scope and limit of the Terry stop.
So it's just the reasonable articulable suspicion of the spider web crack that is supporting the request to exit the vehicle.
That and coupled with officer safety, because officers can ask individuals to exit the car. They can, you know, in this case, he had an apron that had large, bulky, appearing to be metal objects, so they did a brief frisk just for officer safety. They didn't reach into any pockets. No one claims that they did or anything like that. It was a very brief frisk for officer safety, and that's fully supported by the Askertooth decision. I'd like to address some of the evidentiary arguments and the assertions that appellant makes in their reply brief, because I think that it shows two things. One, that many of the arguments are quite strained on appeal, and they have to twist the record beyond what it actually represents in order to make the argument. And two is, quite honestly, I think someone who read that reply brief would walk away with a different view of what this case actually is about. I'd like to start with the appellant's assertion that the state failed to submit any image of the windshield to prove that the crack or limited, that it obstructed the driver's view. That's on page 4 of the reply brief. I would just say that's factually incorrect. Exhibit 2 and Peterson's body-worn cameras as exhibits 6 and 7 showed that it was large cracks in the windshield. Furthermore, I also want to note, it's not required that the state has to take a square photograph of the windshield in order to meet its burden showing that the officers had reasonable articulable suspicion. Rather, that can be supported with the direct testimony of the officers, like was done here. On pages 10, 16, 17, 34, and 42 of the transcript of the omnibus hearing, the officers talk about the extent of the cracked windshields. Finally, I also want to note, as I actually understood the argument to be what Judge Larson understood the argument to be, which is, you know, they may have been justified in the initial stop, but then they unlawfully expanded it. It seems now that they're actually taking the position that that initial stop was not allowed for the windshield cracks. That seems new to me, or perhaps I didn't read the brief close enough. But I would just note that they actually waived that argument below. On page 11 of the memorandum that was issued, or that was submitted in support of the motion to suppress, they specifically said, yeah, the officers saw the windshield crack. They were authorized to stop that initial vehicle. So they seemed to waive that below. Additionally, at page 42 of the transcript, counsel for appellant said, and if I can have it, quote, "We don't have a dispute about a cracked windshield." So I just think at this point in time, the best argument that they can make is that the expansion of that initial search was unconstitutional. They don't prevail on that, but that's the best argument that they can make.
Can I just direct you in some of the time that you have left to kind of zoom ahead to the possession issues and the idea of whether or not he had constructive possession over the firearm.
Sure.
And in your brief, you argue for that we would apply a direct evidence standard of review. Can you help me understand why that would be the case? Because it seems to me that when we're looking at constructive possession, we need to look at whether the defendant consciously exercised dominion and control, and how does DNA evidence go to that? There seems to be some inferential leap that we're making there. So why wouldn't this circumstantial evidence standard apply?
Sure, Your Honor. I have a few responses to that. First of all, the state was pointing that out because there seems to be a split or a developing split in non-precedential cases from this court that talk about whether DNA evidence represents direct or circumstantial evidence. I do not think that this is the case where this court should resolve that split because the DNA forensic analysts didn't testify here. They weren't subject to a full, direct, robust testimony, cross-examination about the extent and scope of the DNA testing. You see that kind of in those other cases. So I don't think that this court needs to resolve that split. And that's why the state's position is it should assume without holding that the circumstantial evidence standard applies because the record so amply meets that circumstantial standard. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Well, counsel, isn't it like a fingerprint? It's circumstantial, but it's often much stronger than direct evidence.
Right, Your Honor. And that's kind of where the dispute with those, you know, kind of developing, not circuit split, but split in the panels. They talk about, well, it shows that he or she directly physically possessed it if you can show that their DNA evidence was on it and that the DNA forensic evidence, you know, can talk saying, the strength of DNA evidence shows that they physically possessed it. That's kind of the idea, is that, well, is that direct or circumstantial? But again, for purposes of this case, I think this court should assume the circumstantial evidence applies because even under that heightened standard, the court still has to construe the evidence in a light most favorable to the verdict. And all of the evidence that's present here showed conscious, constructive possession over the items in the vehicle. That's just what the record shows. And to illustrate that, I think Judge Larson asked them what their best case or, you know, that, to represent their sufficiency argument is, and I don't really see one that they offer. If you look at the cases that are cited in their apposite authority, they're general cases that are kind of landmark cases that have general legal principles to be applied. The closest that they cite would be the State v. Sam decision, but that is woefully different compared to what we have here. In State v. Sam, there were two people that were in a car when the police executed the traffic stop. The drugs were located in the glove box, and the driver gave a false name. That was about the record in that case that justified reversal. Compare that to what we have here. We have a solo occupant of a vehicle. We have a vehicle that appears to be something that occupant has driven before. The occupant has multiple items of personal use strewn throughout the vehicle. And, you know, instead of being in the glove box, like in State v. Sam, the gun was under the driver's seat where the driver was located, which is proximity and ease of access, which are both recognized factors for analyzing whether constructive possession is found. Just the fact of the matter is that the best case that I can read their brief as positing, State v. Sam just is entirely different and in fact shows the strength of the record in this case.
Do you want to briefly address the cannabis issue, which does seem
somewhat, I'm very curious to hear how you finish that question.
I mean somewhat challenging in light of recent changes in the law when that's, I don't know that it's often that that's the person's only felony conviction. It's quite old and sure. Would certainly not be a felony today.
Yes, I would like to respond to that in 2 points. First, on page 18 of the reply brief, they say that the Register of Actions does not include any detail about whether the underlying conviction was for possession of an illegal controlled substance. I think that is just factually wrong. On pages 1 and 2 of the Register of Actions, it states clearly that he was convicted with and charged of one count of, quote, drugs, fifth degree, possessed Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4, not small amount marijuana. So the Register of Actions, the certified copy that was introduced here, shows that their assertion is wrong. It shows that it was a qualifying offense. Second of all, to Your Honor's point, I think that it's telling that they didn't even wrestle with the State v. Weber cite from the state's respondent's brief, because that very clearly states that the crime of violence is triggered at the point of time when the conviction is entered, and it continues for your lifetime. It's forward-looking, not backward-looking. Once that conviction for a crime of violence is entered, that's it. And as State v. Weber notes, the legislature knows how to subsequently amend provisions to, you know, cut out certain classes of individuals if they want them to be excluded from consideration of crimes of violence. The legislature could have written a law that says that, and they haven't.
Well, isn't this exactly what the, like, expungement board is trying to deal with?
And, Your Honor, I'm going to admit that's beyond the record. I'm not maybe familiar with those current developments, so I apologize for that.
But that if this was expunged, if he had had this expunged from his record, then it would be legal for him to possess a gun. But there's a process that you need to go through to have that expungement happen under the new statutes, is my understanding of the new statutes regarding cannabis.
And I apologize at the extent of my knowledge about it. I can't state for certain whether he would then be able to possess a firearm or if he got it expunged. I just don't know that, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you is that he didn't get his crime of violence in this case expunged, period. And so that's on the books. And as the state argues, their argument is one of policy and one of legislative change. And they can freely make it to the legislature if they want. But the legislature hasn't done what they're asking this court to do, and this court can't do what they're asking this court to do. Unless the court has any remaining questions, the state would ask this court to affirm the district court's order denying the suppression motion and to affirm that there is sufficient evidence supporting the verdict.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Bentley, you had asked why DNA evidence is not enough to be direct, and I'd like to provide an answer to that. I think as the Ross case and the Smith cases that are cited in our brief show, DNA evidence doesn't show conscious dominion and control at the time of arrest. That's what you're asking yourselves. But there's a reasonable explanation for the DNA here that would show that it wasn't necessarily something that he had possessed at the time of arrest, because if you look at Exhibit 7, the DNA analysis conducted by the technician, that technician says DNA lasts potentially forever on an object. We don't know how long it's been there. So you can't just rely on DNA evidence. You have to make an inferential leap.
Yeah, but I guess I think I'm with you on that. I don't know. I mean, let's go to the circumstantial evidence world then, right? So if we're in that world, that test requires us not to speculate about other evidence or, other hypothetical reasons for the, as to, what an alternative situation might have been, that it wasn't that he was in exclusive control or had exercised dominion and control over it. It was really that he had maybe sneezed on it a year ago. I don't know what the other hypothetical is, but the point is we can't speculate about that. We have to have some evidence in the record from which we can draw that. So what evidence in the record could you point us to that would support this alternative theory?
Well, I think that if you look at Exhibit 7 and 8, it talks about shedding. What is shedding? It's you're in an area, your skin is coming off, you're sweating, you're breathing, et cetera. These are all ways in which DNA emanates from you. And the state argues, well, he's in proximity to this weapon, and so that shows that, this circumstantial evidence is so strong that he had possession and control. We actually think that actually proves there's an increased likelihood for shedding because he's closer to where
again,
the weapon is.
Again, this is kind of speculating, right? I mean, it would be one thing if we had evidence in the record that the particular kind of DNA that they found of his was for a little bit of work in DNA world that I've done, there are all different kinds of DNA, some of which you can parse together from small bits that are fragments of DNA, right? And if there had been fragments here and not, but here I thought the evidence was that his DNA was the most significant of any of the other people on there. I mean, again, we don't. What do we draw from that would give us the inclination this was just skin, and it was also underneath a seat, and you're kind of like, well,
Right. So if you're asking yourself, did he have conscious possession and control at the time of this arrest? You're asking yourselves, well, was he the only one with DNA? No, there was other DNA on the car. Is it his vehicle? No. Were there fingerprints on there that matched to his? No. I think in addition, we're talking about a rusted old revolver that's tucked away under the seat like that. It wasn't even inoperable, as Exhibit 1, the accounts of the officers, shows. So you have these additional pieces that cast, in my view, serious doubt on whether he possessed this anywhere near the time of arrest, let alone ever. And it's really the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did. And they didn't do that here. And I think that when you actually look at the evidence that they did try to put in and the evidence in the record, it actually shows there are multiple reasonable explanations for why he might have had the DNA evidence on him. But beyond that, there's any of those other factors would never be sufficient under the court's precedent to find that there's conscious dominion control over
So do you think that, so let me, just so I understand your point on the circumstantial evidence, are you suggesting that there's not even evidence from which a fact finder could infer guilt here? So you're challenging that for, because in circumstantial evidence, we first look at, could a reasonable fact finder infer guilt? If yes, then we still go to the next step, which is, well, are there other reasonable, and I was kind of in that world, but are you saying there's not even enough evidence here from which someone could infer guilt?
I think it's both, because if you look at any of the cases in which they, guilt is inferred, there are, is additional testimony, right? Someone is talking about how they are somehow connected to this weapon. There's no evidence of that whatsoever in this case. And so then I think, additionally, for the same reasons. Your Honors, I see I'm running close on time, but I would very much like to address the conviction piece, the felony crime of violence piece, if I may, and just respond to a couple of key points that have been raised by the government. The Weber case, I think, is distinguishable because it doesn't involve a situation in which the state decriminalized a crime. The Weber case involved a district court judge deeming a felony that was charged in a different way for the purposes of sentencing. It didn't involve decriminalization. When the legislature acts to decriminalize possession of marijuana and did that in advance of his arrest, that's a clear expression of intent not to treat those prior convictions as felonies.
But I guess I'll ask the same question that I asked the state. I mean, it seems to me like this is precisely what the, like, sort of expungement efforts are for. And so the fact that your client hasn't yet, there wouldn't be a need, if the legislature intended what you're supposing, there wouldn't be a need for this whole expungement process because we could just ignore the fact that these prior felonies occurred because we've decriminalized. And it seems to me like the existence of the expungement board and the expungement process runs counter to the argument that you're making. I guess that's where I find tension with your argument.
I see your point, Your Honor, but here we have to think about the timeline. The Minnesota legislature decriminalized mere months before this happened. There's no time for him to obtain any kind of expungement, and I don't think the board was even set up by that time. So as a factual matter, it would be impossible for him to have done that. And then in addition, I think that I would just point, Your Honors, to a case, State v. Williams, 553 Pacific 3rd, 161. It's an Arizona Supreme Court case from 2024. They're confronting a similar issue. And they say that the combination of legalization along with expungement showed that the defendant could seek post-conviction relief challenging an enhanced sentence. It's not exactly the same, but I think the analysis applies here equally because the Minnesota legislature not only decriminalized marijuana here, but also allowed for an expungement. And I think that this shows that society, as reflected by the legislature's choice, is determining that though that possession of marijuana doesn't pose a public safety risk, so treating it as a crime of violence dilutes the purpose of the entire felon in possession statute, and it allows old, frankly, racially skewed convictions to drive new convictions with large mandatory minimums that perpetuate inequity that these new laws of decriminalization are designed to prevent and address. For those reasons, we do ask that you reverse the conviction in this case, and thank you very much.
Thank you to counsel, both counsel, for their arguments in this matter. This case has been submitted, and we will issue our decision in the time prescribed by statute. That ends our oral argument calendar, and we will adjourn to confer on our non-oral cases.